Okay. So, thanks very much. It's very nice to be here to give this talk. It's nice to talk about these problems to mathematicians rather than to chemists, because if you talk about them to chemists, by and large, they have no idea what you're talking about. And so there's some advantage in talking to a more mathematical audience for these things. So I want to start by making a list of people who've contributed to this. We've been working on this problem for about 5 years, and one of my friends said that when I started to give this talk, it would be quicker if I made a list of my friends who hadn't made a contribution to it, but here's my list of people who have. So I'll just mention where each of these people are. Serena Calso used to be a postdoc in Toronto. She's now in Pisa. Edna James is a postdoc in Toronto who is here in the audience. Richard Martin was a graduate student in Toronto and is now our man in North Africa. He's in the diplomatic corps. So a graduate degree in chemistry can take you to far afield. Maria Sabaya Mogadam was a graduate student who's now in California. Enzo Orlandini was a postdoc who's now in Padua. Andrew Rechnitzer was a postdoc who's now a faculty member in University of Melbourne. Carla Tesi, a postdoc who's now a faculty member in Bologna. Bux van Rensburg and Neil Madras are both, you know, and I'm sure they're both at York University. And Frank Den Hollander is in Holland, in Eindhoven. So I want to talk about this problem of randomly colored self-avoiding warts as a model of random copolymers. So that's the game. So let me start by trying to tell you what the physics is behind this. What kind of problem are we trying to address? So what's a random copolymer? You have to think of a random copolymer as a sequence of points, and these points you may as well put on the integers, and you associate a color with each of these points. And so I want to think of these colors as being of two types. I'll call them red and blue and A and B, more or less interchangeably. And these are supposed to represent two kinds of monomers in a long polymer chain. So a long polymer chain you can think of as a chain of beads, and the beads have some chemical identity, and in this case there are just two possibilities. And it's a copolymer if there are two possibilities. It's a random copolymer if the sequence is chosen according to some random process. So that's sort of the gross picture of what you have to have in mind. But you don't really have to think of these as being points strung out in a line in one dimension, because the polymer will have different conformations. And it think of it as a piece of string sort of squiggling around in three-dimensional space. And so this is some typical conformation. I've just drawn some conformation of what the polymer might have. And the sequence of monomers are, you know, monomer 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. along here. And this sequence of colors, once it's chosen at the beginning of the game, is fixed. So as you change the conformation of the polymer, the sequence of colors stays the same. And that's an essential piece of it, because if I did it the other way around, the whole thing is trivial. So it's really important that this sequence of colors is fixed from the beginning. Okay. So just to sort of fix our ideas, let me give some examples of three or four physical situations in which this kind of thing can happen. Or I might just say that some biological cases where you have copolymers, or things like proteins or DNA or RNA, I mean, DNA was in the news last week in Toronto because of the Human Genome Conference that happened in Toronto. And so DNA has four comonomers, proteins have 20 comonomers, but we only have two. So the first example I want to mention is called polymer collapse. So imagine that you have this polymer molecule in solution at high temperatures. Then the polymer takes on all kinds of different conformations, and the only thing which is important is the entropy of the system, which means it just wants to explore its configurational space, the possible conformations that the polymer can have, and there are no really important energetic terms in the game. And so you have this wide range of different conformations available, and it looks sort of vaguely like this. Now you imagine dropping the temperature. Well, as you drop the temperature, energetic terms become the important thing, and it might be in the situation where one kind of monomer likes to be next to another kind of monomer, and so you might imagine that the thing will collapse down. So a situation here where it's turned into a more compact object at low temperatures. And if the monomers are of two different kinds, you might imagine that the red monomers like to be next to red monomers, and the blue monomers like to be next to blue monomers, or maybe the red monomers like to be next to blue monomers. But at least this sequence of monomers is going to play some role in determining the energy of a particular conformation, and therefore the probability of occurrence of a particular conformation. So another example is polymer adsorption. So now you have to think of an impenetrable plane, a flat plane, a flat surface, which is impenetrable, and on one side of this is a solution, and there's this polymer molecule sitting in the solution. At high temperatures, entropy is driving the bus, and the polymer molecule is just wandering around in the three-dimensional space, in the half space, and as you decrease the temperature, the polymer starts to interact. The interactions of the polymer with the surface become more important, and it will adsorb at the surface. So this is a typical situation. And if this had been a copolymer with two kinds of comonomers, then maybe only one of the monomers wants to be on the surface, the other one doesn't care, it's equally happy to be in the half space or in the surface. And a third example is something to do with why milk goes sour, in fact. So imagine that you have two liquid phases, which are called alpha and beta, and an interface between them, so this line is supposed to represent the interface between them. And now you have this copolymer where one kind of monomer likes to be in the alpha phase and the other kind of monomer likes to be in the beta phase. So there's an energetic reason for the thing crossing this interface frequently so that it gets the A's in the alpha phase and the B's in the beta phase, say. So at low temperatures you get this feature, this situation, and at high temperatures you get the opposite, that the energetic terms become unimportant, the polymer picks one of the two phases, and it just wanders off into that phase. So these are three kinds of problems that one can try to model by the kind of model that I'm going to talk about today. We know quite a lot about B, and we know a little bit about C, and practically nothing about A. Polymer collapse, people have been working on this problem for 50 or 60 years. We know almost nothing more about it now than we did 50 or 60 years ago. I mean, it's a tale of woe. Lots of very good people have worked on this problem, and it's we've got nowhere. Yes, for the sort of classic kind of model that I'm going to talk about, which is a self-aborting warp model, then it turns out that we know nothing more about the polymer collapse now than we did 50 years ago. No, you're right, that of course you can build particular models where you can do it.
And you claim that the self-avoiding what is the start of your parental logical
thing? No, of course not. I'm saying the self-avoiding walk is a mathematical model which has attracted a lot of attention and which has some of the features which are in real polymers. You can build simpler models. They have the advantage you can do them mathematically. They have the disadvantage that they become even less realistic. Well, I'll say that in a minute. Yeah, give me a few minutes. Well, I mean, I want to know, is there a phase transition in this system? Can I build a free energy? Is the free energy a non-analytic function of something, some control parameter like the temperature? That's the kind of game that we'll play. But that's what I'm going to come to. So let me say something about a model. And so the model I'm going to talk about is self-avoiding walks. And so I'll just take one transparency to talk a little bit about what a self-avoiding walk is. So this kind of model is a much beloved model in statistical mechanics of polymers. They were introduced 50 or 60 years ago, and there's been an enormous amount of work on these models. Now let me just explain what's going on. So you start by considering a lattice, and it doesn't really matter what this lattice is. So the red lines are the square lattice, and this blue object is a walk on this lattice. And the walk just goes from vertex to vertex of the lattice along nearest neighbor edges, or edges which join nearest neighbor vertices, with the restriction that once you've gone to a vertex, you can't go back to that vertex. That's what the self-avoiding condition is. And so you might want to count these things. That's the first thing you could try to do. So how many of these are there? So I'm going to call C sub n, the number of self-avoiding walks with n edges, n steps. And so on this lattice, C1 is 4. I could have gone north, south, east, or west. C2 is 12, because after the first step, which I can take in four directions, I can take the next one in three directions, turn left, turn right, go straight. That's 12. C3, again, I can take the first one in four ways, the next one, turn left, turn right, go straight, And then the third one, turn left, turn right, go straight, so that's 36. And the first interesting thing happens after four steps, where I can't go around and form this little circuit with four edges. So that turns out to be, well, it's 3 times C3 minus the number of these circuits. You can just work out what this is. You end up with C4 being 100. And you can do the same thing with five steps or six steps. At five steps, you want to take a step and then avoid having a circuit which comes back in four steps. With six steps, you want to avoid these two kinds of configurations, two steps and then a circuit with four or a circuit with six. And you can just count these things and you find C6 is 780 or whatever. These numbers are known exactly on this lattice up to about n equals 40. There's kind of an industry, a cottage industry in this game, of counting these things exactly on a computer. And as each generation of computers gets you another couple of steps. It's sort of a law of diminishing returns. If we sat around until 2 o'clock, we could perhaps make it to C9 or C10, and if we spent the afternoon, we might manage C11 or C12, and in a month's time, C13 or C14. And getting two more steps is about a PhD thesis in the current situation in this game, unless you move to a new generation of computers and use an old algorithm. Well, the trouble with getting C40 or something doesn't tell you anything about C41. And so it would be nice to say something about the asymptotic behavior. So one thing you can do is to get bounds. So it's easy to show on this lattice that Cn is at least 2 to the n. I just take my steps along either the positive x or the positive y direction, and then certainly I can't form a circuit. So that's a lower bound on the number of self-avoiding walks with n steps. And I can get an upper bound by considering a class of walks which contain all the self-avoiding walks, and I'll consider the class in which you just don't have a reversal of a step. So that certainly includes all the self-avoiding walks. That's taking the first step in four ways and all succeeding steps in three ways. And it's a theorem, an old theorem due to Hammersley and Morton in the 1950s, that lim 1 over n log cn exists. And so, and I'll call that kappa d if I'm in d dimensions, kappa 2 if I'm in 2 dimensions. So this number, this limit exists. And obviously it lies between log 2 and log 3. And the value of kappa d isn't known on any lattice. There's no that hasn't been determined rigorously for any except trivial cases. So it's it's sort of depressing. 50 years of work and we don't know the answer for any of these cases. There's no case where we know the answer. Another interesting question is how rapidly is the limit approached? I mean, as n gets larger, how rapidly does 1 over n log cn approach kappa d? Well, there's practically nothing known about that too. But the one thing you have to take out of this slide is the existence of this limit, because that's what we're going to use as I go along. There's a conjecture for the hexagonal lattice. And for the hexagonal lattice, mu for that lattice is conjectured to be the square root of 2 plus root 2. It's almost certainly right. I mean, there's lots of evidence that that's right, but there's no proof. And there isn't just numerical evidence, but there's other kinds of evidence for it. Okay, so now, if I want to model these copolymers, now I want to do this coloring process. So now I want to talk about coloring my vertices. So what I'm going to do is generate a sequence of colors. I'll just have two colors, red and blue, by some process, some random process. So for instance, in the case I'll talk about, I'll color these things independently. So it's red with probability p and blue with probability 1 minus p. So I generate this infinite sequence, chi1, chi2, chi3, by this process. So this is just a realization of this process. And then with this sequence of colors fixed, the ith vertex of each walk inherits this color chi I. So chi I is red or blue, 1 or 0 or whatever. And the ith vertex of the walk gets that color. And then I consider all the set of all possible walks with n steps, each of which has the set of colors, and the sequence of colors is the same on each walk. Okay? So chi is fixed at the beginning. Eventually you want to average over chi, but for the moment it's fixed. And this is an example of what people in statistical mechanics call the quench random system. It's random. It's quenched in the sense that you fix the sequence of colors and then it's fixed for all time, and you do the statistical mechanics with that sequence of colors fixed. Thank you. So a good question is, to what extent do the properties depend on this particular sequence? This isn't what I'm really going to talk about, but I'll just mention this kind of problem. So supposing I have some property of the set of walks, I'll call it Pn of chi. N is the length of the walk, chi is the colouring, and I take some property without saying what that is. So if Pn of chi converges to P independent of chi as n goes to infinity, then this property Pn is called self-averaging. So it's just the word that's used for it. And for a lot of the problems that I've talked about, actually for problems 2 and 3 in my examples, the self-avoiding walk version, the free energy self-averages. So when I'll describe what that is in a minute, I'll talk about free energies in a minute, but the free energy self-averages. But this leaves a whole pile of other questions. How rapidly does it self-average? As n goes to infinity, how rapidly, what's the width of the distribution of Pn of chi? You'd think there'd be a central limit theorem, but nobody's managed to prove a central limit theorem for this. On the other hand, there's something which is sort of something like a law of the iterated logarithm, but not quite as strong as that. And what about other properties? If the free energy self-averages, do its derivatives, does the energy, does the heat capacity self-average? Well, there are loads of open questions in this game, and more questions than answers, really. Can we construct particular sequences where we're guaranteed that we have self-averaging for a particular sequence of these chi's? Well, to some extent, but again, there are lots of open questions. But this is really just to raise a sort of an area where people are working rather than talk about it. So let me pick one of these three problems, the last one, localization, and talk about this from the point of view of these self-avoiding walk models. Okay, so obviously I'm drawing the pictures in two dimensions, but this is what I say works in any dimensionality. So this works on the lattice ZD, but I'll draw all the pictures in two dimensions. So I have a line, the line y equals 0, say, which represents the interface between these two phases, two liquid phases, alpha and beta. And I have a self-avoiding walk, which for convenience I'm going to make start on this line. And it wanders around, it crosses the line. And the walk has this sequence of colors. So the reds and the blues is the sequence of colors that we started with, randomly chosen. And I'm going to ask for something about the thermodynamics of this object as a function of the temperature, and that's going to depend on the energy function that we attach to it. So here's the one we're going to use. So the basic configurational data, the sort of the combinatorial data, is going to be the number of these walks with n steps, which given a particular color in chi, have VA of the vertices, which are labeled A, or red, in the alpha phase, and VB of their vertices labeled B in the beta phase. So if a red vertex is in the alpha phase, that's energetically advantageous. If a blue vertex is in the beta phase, that's energetically advantageous. If a red vertex is in the blue phase or a blue vertex is in the red phase, we just ignore it. That's not contributing anything. There's lots of other functionals you could choose. That's the one I'm going to talk about. So the partition function, which is really just the two-variable generating function of this thing, is just the sum over VA and VB of this configurational data, Cn of VA, VB given chi, with this weight function, e to the alpha VA plus beta VB. So this is, if you like to think of it in the sense that if I knew this function, I could extract the Cn's, so generating function in that sense, and in statistical mechanics, this sort of contains the thermodynamic data. So the free energy, well, we now have to ask what free energy. I could ask, normally in free energy, you take the logarithm of the partition function, you divide by n to make it intensive, to make it per vertex, and then you want to know what the large n behavior is, so you'd like to set the limit of this as n goes to infinity. But the first thing you might try to do is, first of all, to average this, the logarithm of the partition function over all possible colorings, and then take the limit as n goes to infinity. Okay. So just take my word for it, this limit exists. You can prove it exists by a concatenation argument, and the fact that it exists means that the system has a thermodynamics. It has a large N behavior, which is sort of well-defined. And now the interesting thing is to find out what we can about this quantity kappa bar of alpha beta. So it's called the quenched average free energy for the system, and it's this quantity that we want to know about. We want to know about the alpha and beta dependence of this. So alpha is sort of measuring in this the extent to which the vertices of type A want to be in the alpha phase, and beta is measuring the extent to which the vertices of type B want to be in the beta phase. Okay. Well, I have two energy terms, if you like, but yes, if you like, I have two temperatures. I mean, if I went along in the alpha-beta plane and went along lines going through the origin, then that would be a single temperature running along those lines. But I'd like to look at the whole behavior in terms of these two functions, these two quantities, alpha and beta. So let me just say something about the intuition, first of all. So suppose that alpha is positive and beta is negative. So if alpha is positive, that means that the alpha term is trying to pull the A vertices into the alpha phase. And if beta is negative, that means that the B vertices are being pushed out of the beta phase. So what does that say? Well, the A vertices are pulled into the alpha phase, the B vertices are pushed out of the beta phase, so everything wants to go into the alpha phase. So we'd expect that the thing spends its time in the alpha phase, and this is called delocalization into the alpha phase. It just wanders around into that phase. And by a completely similar argument, if alpha is negative and beta is positive, it's delocalized into the beta phase. So now the B's are pulled into the beta phase, the A's are pushed out of the alpha phase. Now, suppose that alpha and beta are both positive, then we might think that if alpha and beta are both positive and both sufficiently large, that maybe, so what does this mean? It means the A's are pulled into the alpha phase, the B's are pulled into the beta phase, so maybe the wart will cross this interface frequently in order to minimize its energy to give the maximum number of A's in the alpha phase and the maximum number of B's in the beta phase. Okay. So that means it's localized around the interface. So I've got this interface, now the wart is sort of wandering around crossing this frequently, and that's called localization. And similarly in this region, the A's are pushed out of the alpha, in this quadrant, the A's are pushed out of the alpha phase, the B's are pushed out of the beta phase, and again, that means you might cross the interface frequently. So you might expect that there'd be a phase transition from this region in which it's delocalized into the alpha phase to localized in the beta phase as you run up in the beta direction. So I'd expect there to be a line of singularities in the free energy, or a curve of singularities in the free energy, corresponding to this transition. Okay, so what can we say? So almost the only thing I'm going to sketch the proof of is this, because it's very easy. So let's look, first of all, what happens when alpha is positive and beta is negative. So alpha positive, beta negative means I'm in this region. So I'll just get upper and lower bounds on the on this partition function. So I can write the partition function as sigma over VAVB of CN VAVB given chi, etc. And I can get an upper bound. Beta is negative, so I can forget the beta VA term. Alpha is positive, so I'll bound alpha VA by alpha times the number of A vertices which are in this particular coloring chi, call that A of chi. So I get this inequality. The E to the A of chi comes outside the sum. Then when I sum the CN, I just get the total number of self-aborting walks. So I get this relationship. And, okay, now I get a lower bound. I get a lower bound by considering some subset of these walks, and I'll consider the subset which simply, the walk simply lives in a half space. It spends all its time in the alpha phase. Then all of the A vertices are now in the alpha phase, but now I've only got a subset of the walks, those walks which start on this interfacial plane and live in a half space. But to exponential order, there are the same number of walks in the half space as there are of walks in the whole plane. I mean, that's a theorem. And so that means that this lim, these two limits are the same, lim 1 over n log cn walks in a half space is the lim 1 over n log of the number of self-aborting walks. They're both the same. And so that tells me that kappa bar, this limiting free energy, is p alpha plus kappa d. So I get p alpha because a of chi over n, when I average over the chi's by the strong law of large numbers, goes to p. So I know what the form of the free energy is, and that's a nice thing to know if you're aiming for proving a phase transition.
Okay,
Yeah.
Is there a, like a GitHub sample? I mean, is this still a, just an inert random walk?
It's an inert, well, it's not inert in the sense that it has no interaction with itself except it's self-avoiding, but it has an interaction with its surroundings.
So but you're assuming is the probability density of the Gibbs density?
Yes, it is.
With that
interaction? Yes. It's not an assumption, it's true. I mean, you can prove that.
Well,
you know,
for
this model, there is a Gibbs density. That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
No, but I mean, you could also say just let a random walk and count.
Oh, I could, but that wouldn't have a phase transition.
Right.
Right. So, I mean, I have to put in these energy functionals in order to get a phase transition in the problem. There has to be a temperature dependence. So that's what this weight is doing here. This weight here is what that's doing. Excuse me? Yes, it is. Or if you have a directed walk, they're easier problems, but you still can't do the whole problem. It's easier, you can say rather more, but you still can't solve the whole problem. You can prove there is a phase transition, but you can prove that for the self-avoiding walk case. You can't find the location of the phase boundary in the random walk problem either. It's this business of the quenched average which is causing all the problems. And that's just as bad when it's a random walk or a directed walk as it is when it's a self-avoiding walk. So it's easier to do those problems, but you don't get much more information out of them than you do out of the self-avoiding walk. So you may as well do the self-avoiding walk, which is more interesting. Well, more challenging, I don't know. Okay, so I know what the free energy is now in the fourth quadrant, and by a similar argument, I know what the free energy is in the second quadrant. Follows some particular functional form. Now I want to prove that if I go into the first quadrant, somewhere in the first quadrant it stops having that functional form, then I now have a phase transition. So let me indicate how to do that. So I now want to look at the first quadrant, and I want to consider this particular sequence of colors. So whatever it is, red, red, blue, 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 red, red. Okay. Well, that's a finite sequence of colors, and that will occur with positive density on this infinite sequence chi for almost all chi. So that's a kind of patent theorem argument. It can occur, so if the process is long enough, it will occur with probability 1. So it occurs at least, say, epsilon n times for some positive epsilon on almost all the color sequences. So I'm going to make use of that to get a bound. So everywhere that this sequence red, red, blue, 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 red, red occurs, so I've drawn two examples, I'll arrange it so that two of the blue vertices are living in the beta phase, and everything else sort of pushes through into the alpha phase and spreads out there. What can I point with? Well, you can see. So I have my two blues in the beta phase, a couple more in the interphase, and then the other stuff in the alpha phase. Now I can certainly join up the reds in the alpha phase with the next set of reds in the alpha phase just with a straight line. This has the effect that I put all of the A vertices in the alpha phase and two epsilon n B vertices in the beta phase. Okay, so the total energy of this is A times A of chi times alpha plus 2 beta epsilon n. And so the limiting free energy, this thing, is greater than or equal to alpha p plus 2 beta epsilon. But now if I make beta as big as big enough, whatever epsilon happens to be, if I make beta big enough, that can certainly become larger than kappa d. And so by the time beta is bigger than kappa d over 2 epsilon, certainly the free energy has stopped having this functional form that it had in the fourth quadrant. That means that it's a non-analytic function, and therefore there's a phase transition in the problem. So in fact, it means that the thing has to localize by the time it reaches this horizontal line. And actually, by a similar argument, you can show it has to localize by the time it reaches this line. So somewhere in this region between here and here, there must be a phase boundary, which represents the transition from the delocalized to the localized phase. Okay, so let me try to say that sort of again, and then I'll tell you actually what we know about the nature of that phase boundary without proving anything. I'm just repeating what I said in the last slide, but I want to make sure we know what's going on. So in this quadrant, we know everything about the problem in the sense that we know what the limiting free energy is. In this quadrant, we know what the limiting free energy is. And somewhere far out in this first quadrant, we know that it must have changed its form. And so there must be a phase boundary somewhere in this region. And similarly, although I'm not going to talk about it, similar things happen in this quadrant. So now let me draw what it actually looks like and tell you what we know. So so that's the alpha-beta plane. This is the quadrant in which it's delocalized into the alpha phase. This is the quadrant where it's delocalized into the beta phase. I said that if alpha and beta are both large and positive, it will eventually localize. And actually, similarly, if they're sufficiently large and negative, it will localize. The dotted lines are the lines I had on the last picture, saying that there must be a phase boundary below this dotted line in between there and the axis. And I've just sketched a possible phase boundary. So now, what can we say about the shape of this? So actually, we know quite a few odds and ends about the shape of it. And let me just tell you what they are, without telling you how to prove any of this. So first of all, what we know is that the phase boundary goes through the origin. Apart from at the origin, it's never... I'll just talk about this optant here. And this actually, by the way, is for P equals a half. I'll talk about this optant, this first optant. So the phase boundary goes through the origin. It doesn't touch the x-axis except at the origin. It's monotone, non-decreasing. It's concave. It has a horizontal asymptote, but we don't know where it is. And that's probably it. That's probably what we know. We have a bound in the sense that we can find a bound on this dotted line, but we don't know what the horizontal asymptote is. Okay, so they're the sort of things that one can prove about this. So now let me say some of the things that we have no idea about. So these are open questions, things that we don't know the answers to. What's the detailed shape of the phase boundary? It would be nice to have a function, beta critical of alpha, which told me exactly what that function was. We haven't got a clue what that is, except the rather general things I was able to say. An interesting question about it is that function an analytic function of alpha? If it's not analytic, is it? Can I show that it's differentiable a few times, that it's... has at least a few derivatives? Well, no, we have no idea. We know it's continuous, but we don't know anything beyond that. What about the nature of the singularities as you cross the phase boundary? So imagine that I'm now... I'm now sitting in this phase, and I cross this phase boundary. I know that the free energy is singular when I cross the phase boundary. What's the nature of that singularity? So in statistical mechanics, that's the question of what's the order of the phase transition. Well, we know nothing about this. We haven't got a clue from a rigorous point of view as to what the order of the phase transition is. So there's, as usual, as many questions as answers in this, more questions than answers. Let me show you a numerical calculation to show you what we can say numerically about it. So these are estimates of the location of the phase boundary by a numerical technique that I don't really plan to talk about. So it does all the things that I said qualitatively. Well, that's no surprise. We can prove it has to do all those things, so it's not a big surprise that it does. But, I mean, this locates the phase boundary in the sense that we really know where it is with some error bars. It's interesting that there isn't symmetry between the first and the third quadrants, and that's something to do with the fact this interface plays a special role. It's not an easy thing to see, but there is a special role played by the interface. These, in this quadrant where we know more, this is a rigorous bound on where the phase boundary has to be, and in fact, well, it lies between the axis and this. This is another bound, which is a mixture of a rigorous result and a numerical estimate for a particular quantity in that rigorous argument. And so it's pretty close to where the thing seems to be. So that's positive news. We can't actually get that the value of that parameter by a rigorous argument, but we know that it has a certain form, that bound has a certain form, and we can estimate the parameter numerically. Yes? It's something to do with the fact that it's rather a long explanation, but I'll try to catch it in a word or two at least. When in the first quadrant, the walk is pulled into the alpha phase, the A's are pulled into the alpha phase, and the B's are pulled into the beta phase. So if they're in the interface, there's no advantage. In the third quadrant, they're being pushed out of the alpha phase and pushed out of the beta phase. So apart from going into the opposite phase, they can also sit in the interface. It's a kind of a safe haven. And that's what leads to this asymmetry between the two quadrants.
Does that actually reflect chemistry?
No, it doesn't. It's a feature of the model that oughtn't to be there. But it's there. Too bad. I can't do it without that at the moment. Yeah? Yeah, you could probably do that model, but it hasn't been done. Yes, I'd expect you have symmetry between the two quadrants in that case. Yes, or you could have a little region representing the interface rather than a plane, and again you'd have the same feature. But they just haven't been worked out. I don't think it's impossible to do those things; they just haven't been done. Okay, so I want to sort of decorate this model now. I want to make it slightly more complicated. And the reason, in a way, why we have this special interfacial plane is so we can do this next decoration of the model. So now I want to have a special interaction of the vertices of the walk with this interfacial plane. So now I'm not only going to count the number of... So I have a colouring, chi. Now I count the number of vertices coloured A, which are in the alpha phase, vertices colored B, which are in the beta phase, and the number of vertices of either color, which are in this interfacial plane. Okay, so W is the number of vertices in the interfacial plane. So the partition function now has this third parameter, alpha, beta, and gamma. So Michael will say, I've now got three temperatures, not two. So there are three energy terms in this. And the free energy now is... quenched average free energy is the limit of 1 over n, the expectation with respect to the colorings of the logarithm of the partition function. Again, you can prove that limit exists, so this is a well-defined quantity. And now let's try to think what's going to happen in this case. So the first thing you could look at is making gamma negative. So if gamma's negative, that means that the vertices are being repelled from the interfacial plane. So now there's an energetic disadvantage for a vertex to stay in the plane. So that means it's going to cross this interface. It's going to cross it as rapidly as possible so as to avoid sitting there. It's not going to follow the interface for a while and then cross. So what do we expect? Because the interface is repulsive, it's harder to localize the walk. And so if I plot this as the phase boundary when gamma is zero, when there is no... interaction, no repulsion with the interfacial plane, there are two possibilities. One is that this curve simply lies above this curve. This is some negative gamma, but never touches the red line. The other is that it follows the red line for a while, and then has a special point here at which it then moves off. They're the two options that I can see. And so it would be nice to decide between these. If we had this situation, then it would mean, you have to forget the black curve now, I'm just looking at the green curve here, then it would mean that if I cross this in this direction, there would be a first-order phase transition when I cross this region of the green curve, which is a 45-degree line. So that would be an interesting thing if that turned out to be true. Unfortunately, it's not true. We can prove that it has this form and not this form. So that we know that when gamma is negative, it doesn't actually change any of the qualitative features. It just moves the phase boundary around, but it doesn't change any of the qualitative features that we can say anything about. What about when gamma is positive? So when gamma's positive, now we have an attraction for the interface. The vertices are attracted to the interface, and so that should make it easier to localize. And so it might be that the phase boundaries no longer meet at the origin. You know, we had these phase boundaries in the earlier pictures where I had these four curves meeting at the origin. So now it might be that they no longer meet at the origin, but that I have two curves, this lower curve and the other one, and that the localized regime just spreads out between the two. So this is localized here and this is localized here, and we have this region between them. They're not just joined at the origin, but there's sort of a nice region between them. Well, that's true. We can prove that for gamma large enough, at least, that turns out to be true. So now I want to introduce three numbers, gamma 1, gamma 2, and gamma 3, so that they obey this relationship, 0 less than or equal to gamma 1, less than or equal to gamma 2, less than or equal to gamma 3. So gamma 0 is the value of gamma, so that if I choose that value for gamma, then the origin is localized, is in the localized phase. Okay? So for every gamma greater than gamma 1, 0, 0, gamma in that plane, the origin in that plane, is in the localized phase. Gamma 2 is so that if gamma is bigger than gamma 2, the whole of this quadrant is in the localized phase. The whole of the third quadrant is in the localized phase. And if gamma is bigger than gamma 3, the whole plane is localized. Okay. So I claim there are three such numbers. Let me tell you what we know about them. In order to save having complicated expressions, p is a half in this. But we know the answer, whatever p is. So if p is a half, then the following three things are true. Gamma 1 is less than or equal to this complicated expression, 2 kappa d minus kappa d minus 1 minus, well, sinh minus 1 cosh kappa d, complicated looking thing. Kappa d is the is this exponential growth rate for self-avoiding warps in d dimensions. Kappa d minus 1 is the self-avoiding warp growth rate in d minus 1 dimensions. The other is just some mess that comes out. And so I know that if gamma is bigger than that, the origin, 0, 0, gamma, that is localized. I know that if gamma is bigger than kappa d minus 1, then the whole third quadrant is localized. And I know that if gamma is bigger than 4 kappa d, then the whole plane is localized. So I'm going to skip this indication of how to prove that, because I'm running a bit short of time. And just say what these questions are about it. Yes? Yes? It's delocalized, and it's provably delocalized, but it's a funny situation. It's not delocalized into either of the two phases, it's delocalized into both phases. No, it doesn't pick one. It crosses between the two, but rarely. So it spends a long time in this one, and a long time in this one, but it does occasionally cross. Whereas in the cases where it's sort of sitting in the first and third quadrants, then it crosses still, but hardly ever, and all the crossings are very early. So it spent all its time in one of the phases and almost none of its time in the other phase. So the origin is a very special point when gamma is zero. So this really is different to that, because now it's crossing this this interfacial plane at positive density of times. So the first open question is gamma 1 equal to 0 plus? I mean, or 0, I forgot where I put my inequalities. But that is it true that for any positive gamma, 0, 0, gamma is localized? Well, that actually is a question which has been around for 25 years or thereabouts, in a hidden form. I mean, if we knew the answer to this, it would answer a question which has been around since, I don't know, 1980 or thereabouts. So this is an old question and a hard one to try to settle. We thought we had it at one point. There was this moment of euphoria. I mean, you know how it is. We saw this proof, and there's just a little detail that needed working out. And a week later, our euphoria had evaporated. Secondly, could all these gammas be the same? Or could any, could some pair of them be the same? Is gamma 3 strictly bigger than gamma 2 strictly bigger than gamma 1? Well, that's open. We don't know the answer. We have good reason to believe that they're all distinct, but we don't really know. Third, what can we say about the shapes of these phase boundaries? Well, we know some things. We know things like monotonicity and convexity properties, but precious little else about them. And finally, this next question is the nature of the phase transition. Now, I left this till the end, so it's something which is extremely puzzling, and we don't really understand this at all. But I'll tell you what the problem is. So let me go back to my phase boundary when I had gamma equals zero. Okay, so now I give up. I take off my mathematical hat. This is now completely physics, what I'm going to tell you. There's no proof for any of what I'm about to say. It's a mixture of intuition and numerical evidence. There's some reason to believe that when you cross this phase boundary, that the transition is second order, which means that the free energy is continuous and once differentiable, but you can't differentiate twice. When you cross this phase boundary, it's different. You can differentiate at least twice. And so that says that you've got, so this is a higher than second order transition. This is a second order transition. Now, if that's true, there must be a point somewhere at which you switch from being second order to higher than second order. If it's second order somewhere and it's not somewhere else, there must be a point. And the obvious candidate is here. Seems like the obvious place. The evidence is that down here and up here. So we can't rule out the fact that this special point is somewhere else. But now if I look at the same thing when gamma is positive, there's no longer this special point of the origin. And so there are two questions. I don't know the answers to any of these things. One is it true that along here that the phase transition changes its nature at some point along that curve? That is, that it's, maybe, that it's second order here and higher than second order here. We don't know whether that's true or not. There's no evidence in any direction about it. So that's a completely open question. Suppose for the moment that it did, then there must be a point somewhere at which it switches from one to the other. And what's the candidate? Well, I don't know, because I had the origin as my candidate before, and now there doesn't even seem to be a candidate point for this. So this is a set of questions about which we have absolutely no way of getting at the moment, and they're completely open questions from the point of view of trying to prove anything. Okay, so I hope I introduced this kind of mixture of combinatorics and not very difficult analysis, which and a bit of probability thrown in, where it has a kind of an application to a problem which, if you're not really a chemist, you might be persuaded had something to do with chemistry, though I've confessed that if I was talking to a chemical audience, they'd all be shouting at me for the fact that I dreamt up this completely unreasonable mathematical model, and what did it matter if I could say something about it, because it has nothing whatsoever to do with chemistry. Thank you very much.